Greetings, all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph. We're today in lesson 345, and we're going to continue with chapter 25 of the book of Numbers, where we read here the beginning of the story when Balaam was not able to curse Israel. We read later on, obviously at this point we don't read it, but later on we read what really happened here. He told the king and he told others that brought him over there, since he really wanted that money. That's the kind of a man he was. And that's what God knew from the beginning. That's the reason why he got very angry with him, even though he told him to accept the offer to go over there. Even though he told him he's going to bless them, you see, he still was angry with him all along, you know, all the way. And that's where the incident with his talking ass took place later on. Because God knew what was really in his heart. And oftentimes we don't know it. You see, we look at people, and had we been there and seen the prophet and seeing the way he talked, you know, I'm going to do only what God tells me, and I'm not, no matter what you give me, I'm not going to say something else. You see, we would be taken by it and we'll think, oh, what a righteous man it is. And some people in their ignorance, even in the Jewish community, and I heard a lecture about this very subject by a Jewish rabbi, and he basically was voicing the concept and idea of others, thinking that this man was a righteous man. And the reality is that God knows us, what we are really made of, through and through. While people, you know, people generally, when they look at us, when they hear us, they know only the facade. And so he, in essence, suggested, well, okay, I cannot really curse Israel because the only thing I can do is just what God told me, but I can show you something else, one way to get them in trouble, you see, and bring the curse upon themselves. And I don't have to do it. And he did it, obviously, for the only reason, money. Filthy lucre, you see, covetousness. And this is what angered God very much about him, because he knew that it was in his heart. And obviously, the record here doesn't tell us all those things in plain words, but when we read the whole account, from beginning until the end, we begin to understand it. And that's how oftentimes, another way, God records his truth. It's only for those who dig very deeply into it and consider the whole matter. They are the ones who are able to understand it. And oftentimes, some places where it's difficult to know that, even after you read the whole thing, you need the Holy Spirit to lead you to truth, to open your mind, to make you understand what is it that was in the mind of the writer, the mind of God. And so in this case, the prophet, even though we don't read it here, he basically told them, the people that brought him over to curse Israel, well, there is another way of getting Israel, and this is the way we're going to read about it. This is what's happening here. And so we read that he got them into basically fornication, idolatry, and things like that, and worshipping of idols. And that was his concept, his idea. And if you want to read, you know, jump forward to see that, let's go to chapter 31. In verse 16, where the story continues, this is a time of vengeance that God is taking upon those who are responsible for doing that to his people. And so, they went to war, and God told them through Moses, when you go to war against these people that have brought this curse upon you, you totally decimate them, destroy them, and have absolutely no mercy on anyone. And they didn't do it. They did only partially, and that was a problem for Israel many times. When God tells them to totally eradicate a problem, they're not willing to go all the way. And all of us have that problem. That's a problem of human nature. And so they brought some captives with them, and Moses says here in verse 15, obviously he's very angry with that, he says, and Moses said unto them, have you saved all the women alive? They were supposed to kill all of them. Behold, this caused the children of Israel, through the counsel of Balaam, to revolt so as to break faith with the Lord in the matter of Peor. And so the plague was among the congregation of the Lord, you see. He's basically revealing here who was really behind it. It was Balaam. That was his counsel. You know, you can't get them by cursing them, because God is not going to curse them. He's not going to listen to our desire for it. In other words, that's also a principle. If you pray contrary to the will of God, he's not going to do it. So whenever we pray to God, we have also to understand that we should know first what is the will of God about this matter, before we can even begin to pray. Otherwise, it's going to be a prayer in vain. And to begin with, if we pray to God for something that is wrong, He's going to be very upset with us. And, you know, we don't want to be in that condition. That's exactly what happened here with Balaam. They came to ask him to come and curse Israel. And it's not something that he really wanted to do, but he wanted the money. You see? And so his attitude was, well, I don't know. I know that God doesn't like that, but, you know, I wonder if there is any way to go anywhere and get the money. You see? So in essence, he was praying against the will of God. And he ultimately did it in a very sneaky manner. Israel didn't know it, but God knew it. Moses knew it, and so he told them, you go kill that person who is responsible along with the others. And they did, ultimately. And so we read here at this point that when they committed, let's begin from the beginning so we can have a continuity, even though we read it already. And Israel abode in Shittim, and the people began to commit harlotry with the daughters of Moab. You see, without background, you don't know what happened here. Well, Balaam is the one that counseled them to do that. So it was a setup, entrapment. And they called the people unto the sacrifices of their gods. And the people did eat and bowed down to their gods. Now, this is not talking about all of Israel, obviously, but the ones among them who were weaklings, you see, and there are always those people who are easily given to foolishness, and they went for it. And to begin with, you know, they were hungry for the wrong things, and so they were willing to do it. Now, they proved it already when they were in Mount Sinai with the golden calf. Now, here we're talking about the second generation. But you see, as like father, like son, that's what happened to some of them. They learned too well from the example of their fathers instead of learning to do the other way, seeing the end result of their parents' behavior. Well, they followed in their footsteps. And these are the people that basically were involved. Not all of Israel, some of them were. And so at this point, we read, and Israel joined himself. When it says Israel, it doesn't mean the whole nation, but some of them. But you see, God records it in this way because there is collective responsibility here. When the congregation sees some people in their midst do these kind of things, unless they intervene and do something about it, they all become guilty. You see, and that's the way God takes it. And verse 4, and the Lord said unto Moses, take all the chiefs of the people, I'm not talking about all the chiefs of the people, the entirety of the house of Israel, but the ones who are responsible for doing it in particular, you see. And it says, you take them and you hang them. You hang them up unto the Lord in the face of the sun, that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel. Now, God knew what was happening. God knew that Balaam would do that. You see? He knew that he's going to entrap Israel because he himself could not curse. He knew what was in the heart of the prophet. He knew it from the beginning, before he even left his country. And that's why he was angry with him from the beginning. And yet, he also needed to test his own people. And that's what he said many times. A lot of people are not aware of that, and therefore they fall for it. God made it very plain many times through Moses and others that he's going to allow false prophets, he's going to allow deceivers, he's going to allow the devil and his demons, he's going to allow all these things to happen to test his people to see whether they would obey him or not. And a lot of people to our day, to this very moment, are still not learning this lesson. And they are falling for it. And they think that it is from God, that it is okay. And they are being deceived. And they don't realize what spirit is behind it. And that's why when the ultimate happens toward the end of time, when a man of sin appears and begins to do signs and wonders and miracles, a lot of people are going to totally forget what they've learned. Or maybe, you know, their mind and heart is not in it to begin with. And they'll just see that and say, well, no man can do a thing like that. It's got to be of God. And they'll fall for it and they'll go after those kind of people or that person. And there would be several ones who would be doing it, but one chief one among them that will do even more than anybody else. And an awful lot of people who call themselves the people of God, who believe in Jesus Christ, who claim that they follow Him, they're going to fall for it. You see? It's been happening from the Garden of Eden. And God allows it. Because we have to prove to God whether we are the very elect or not, whether we would obey Him or not, regardless of what is happening all around. And the only ones who are going to know the difference, whether it is of God or not, are the ones that study the Word of God day and night. A lot of people are not doing it. They lean to their own understanding and follow their own emotions and feelings. You see, and they decide in their own heart, well, I think it's of God, or I don't think it's of God. You see? And this, unfortunately, are not the spiritual people of God. They're not the very elect. They may be the people of God in many ways, but they're not, you know, the very elect. And so this is what happened to the children of Israel here, and God was very angry with them, even though he allowed it. So they were very unfaithful to him. And that's what he said. You know, you take them and you hang them. That's for the chief leaders who were responsible for it. You know, the leaders are extremely responsible for it, and that's why all of us who want to be leaders, masters, you know, we exalt ourselves to this position or that position. We should remember that. Well, then to be the most guilty and the most responsible for whatever happens. And James warns us about it. Don't be many masters. You know, don't be covetous for authority and power and all those things. Just think, you know, don't think only about the glory and the glamour and all the good things that happen. Remember the accountability, the responsibility, and it's not that pleasant. That's why a lot of the people of God, the servants of God, the prophets of God, when he called them to do a certain thing, they say, hey, please choose somebody else, like Moses said, you know. That's not something I really want to do. Verse 5, and so we read, and Moses said unto the judges of Israel, slay you everyone, his men, that had joined themselves unto Baal, the Baal of Peor. You see, that was the god that they worshipped, Baal. And Peor was the place, where the place that Baal, Lord, that's what it means in English, Baal, Lord, or in Hebrew, Baal, master, owner. A lot of people, you know, hang around all over the place and say, Lord, Lord, Lord. You know, what Lord are they worshipping? Oftentimes it's the false one. They think it's the true one. Because they've got a Lord that tells them, you know, well, you don't need to obey the law of God. It's all done away with. I did it for you and things like that. That's a false Christ, false Lord. That's why God says at the end of time he's going to cut off the name of the Lord's, the Baal, the name of Baaling. You see, a lot of people have Lords all around the earth. Among those who call themselves Christians and other religions, they all have their Baal, their master and their owner and their Lord. And they're all false. They're not the true ones. And so it says you kill everybody that worships the false Lord. And behold, one of the children of Israel. Now, on top of that, somebody's going to show that he's independent-minded. He's going to do whatever he wants. And he doesn't care about Moses or Aaron or anybody. Well, Aaron is not here. He died already. But Moses and all the other leaders. And so we read about that behavior on the part of some. There are always those kind of people. You know, I'm going to show you. I think for myself. You're not going to tell me what to do. And behold, one of the children of Israel came and brought unto his brethren. He didn't do it in secret, you know, over there. No, he brings it in public. He brings that woman, a Midianite woman, in the sight of Moses. Mind you, who is Midian? You see, one of the Midianites, before that, one of the families, produced the wife of Moses. You see, Jethro was a Midianite. Well, that was a righteous Midianite one. Here are Midianites who are not. And they're all the sons of Abraham from Keturah. And that's, you know, this whole thing is the story of, in the family of Abraham. Lot is his nephew, Midianites, you know, and Moab and Ammon are the children of Lot. His nephew and the Midianites are the children of his wife Keturah, and Israel from his wife Sarah. So look what happens in the family of Abraham. And so this man, he brings a Midianitish woman in the sight of Moses, in spite of him. That's what he does it. And in the sight of all the congregation of the children of Israel. He's not afraid. Couldn't care less. While they were weeping at the door of the tent of meeting. They watch all this evil being down there. And obviously they talk to the people and they're not listening. And they do it anyway. They couldn't care less. Just like it happened with the golden calf. And he does it there. What kind of an attitude and spirit is in that man? And now we see somebody springs into action. And when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, now Eleazar is not a high priest, his father is dead, and so Phinehas, the grandson of Aaron, he saw it, well, he couldn't take it, you see. And he took action. He rose up from the midst of the congregation. They were all weeping, and he was not about to go on weeping. He was going to do something about it. That's a responsibility that God places upon the congregation. You sue evil, you get rid of it, root it out. or else you're going to be partakers of the evil, you know, complicity, crime. And it says he rose up from the midst of the congregation and he took a spear in his hand. Now, this is a Levi who must be holy and clean, who is not supposed to touch any dead body, you see, because after that he's going to have to be purified. He would not be able to serve in the temple until he's cleansed and purged and purified. But you see, there is a time, there is a time to give life and there is a time to kill, even by the priest, just like God made it very plain. He's the God of love and of peace and of mercy and kindness and all that, but he's also the God of war. He's a man of war. And some people forget that. There is a time to do battle and destroy. And so this is what he's doing here. He took a spear in his hand, grabbed it from someone, and he went after the man of Israel, you know, that audacious person who couldn't care less about anybody, into the chamber, and, you know, he just went inside into the tent where he took her there and he was having sex with her, intercourse, in the mid-act. And he went over there and thrust both of them through, the men of Israel and the woman, through her belly. So you can imagine that position. And it was not bashful to go inside and see them in the act. He just went over there and he was going to eradicate evil from Israel. And as soon as he did it, we read, so the plague was stayed from the children of Israel because God was killing them, the evildoers. And those that died by the plague were 24,000. Imagine that. Just like that. The lives of 24,000 men were snuffed out. And they had families. I mean, you know, many of them may have been married and had wives and children and all that. And yet they were engaged in all these abominations in the sight of God and fornication and idol worship. And God is not a respecter of persons. And that's what he did. And that was the end result of that. And unfortunately, oftentimes, when we see evil in our midst and we do nothing about it, it becomes even worse. And then God executes the penalty on all. Well, how is God going to react now to what Pinhas had done? We read in, again, chapter 25, and verse 10. And the Eternal has spoken to Moses, saying, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, has turned my wrath away from the children of Israel, in that he was very jealous for my sake among them, so that I consumed not the children of Israel in my jealousy. And he was going to continue to destroy many more. But he said, here is one man that put an end to it. And sometimes that's all it takes, just one man doing the right thing, and then others follow. And oftentimes, unfortunately, that one man is not there. Everybody's, you know, weeping instead of doing something about it, or crying, or mourning, whatever. You know, there is a time and a place. It's not that we should be trigger-happy and do it anytime we want, you see. But sometimes there is a time, and that's the only way you're going to do it. And so God was very pleased with him. And so he said, wherefore say, behold, I give him, I personally am going to give him a covenant of peace. This is one man who is going to make a covenant with that man. A covenant of peace. And it shall be unto him and to his seed after him, not only for him, but all of those who will come after him, the covenant of an everlasting priesthood. Mind you, for one act of righteousness, there is a consequence. And for one act of wickedness, there is also an everlasting consequence. And it can go both ways. So we should be always mindful of what we are doing in life. It's not going to affect only the momentary situation, but it can affect generations to come. And that's what he said here. Because of what he had done here, I shall give him an everlasting priesthood. Because he was jealous for his God and made atonement for the children of Israel. You see, sometimes you make an atonement for the children of Israel by killing a lamb, an animal, and the one time when it happened by a person who gave himself as the Lamb of God, and so he made atonement for Israel, you see, and this is what Pinhas was doing here, a priest, just like his ultimate priest, Jesus Christ. He did not give his life. But, you know, he risked himself. You know, he could have been killed by the other person. But he went over there and he killed him. And he atoned in doing so by shedding blood. He atoned for the blood of the children of Israel. And verse 14 we read, now the name of the man of Israel that was slain. Now God is revealing who is that man. He's not just one of the Israelites, an ordinary person. He says, the man that was slain, who was slain with the Midianitish woman, was Zimri, the son of Salu, the prince of the fathers among, that is, of the house among the Simeonites. So he was a Simeonite, a tribe of Simeon, and that was, unfortunately, the nature of Simeon. You see, there were men of war, there were men of cruelty, like, you know, Levi and Simeon. Well, here it is, Levi and Simeon that anciently went and destroyed the whole city of Shechem, and Jacob said, you know, cursed be their anger and their wrath. Well, here it is now, one that was together with the other one. Well, he turns against his brother, and he kills him. So now Levi kills Simeon. And before that, Levi and Simeon were together killing all those Gentiles that defiled their daughter. You know, one of them did it. But it's quite a twist of events, irony of slash, and that's what happened here. And he killed him. And, you know, there is a time when you should not show respect to persons, because the Simeonites and Levites, you know, were very close to each other. They had similar qualities. And as a matter of fact, as Jacob said, I will spread them among all of Israel. And they were. Oftentimes, they gravitate to each other because of the similar qualities. And when you study history and you know who they are to this very day, you see them oftentimes together in this country. Of course, you have to know the history of the tribes of Israel, who they are, where they went, and all that. But just, you know, throw a clue here. In this country, you find them oftentimes in the south. They're called the rednecks. You see the same qualities of Levi there and Simeon, but especially Simeonites you see there. Good men of war and good men to have on your side, but never double-cross them because you're going to be in trouble. And you find them among all the tribes of Israel, you know, in Europe and other countries. Wherever they are, you find them in Israel, obviously. And generally they're good generals of Israel, the good army men of war, and they have a lot of other good qualities. But this is what happens here. And so this is a man, a chief prince, you know, a prince, that is, of the father's house among the Simeonites. And if, you know, one leader was very involved in it, you can imagine other leaders, you know, they just get together, others with them. And instead of provoking to do right, they provoke them to do evil. And oftentimes that's what happens. Well, God put an end to it. That's the reason why he said, you take all those princes and you just hang them. You see, and who knows how many of them were Simeonites and other tribes. And so this is the man in verse 15. And the name of the Midianitish woman that was slain was Cozbi, the daughter of Tsur, the rock. That was her name, Tsur, the rock. And that's the kind, you know, wrong kind of rock. And he was the head of the people of her father's house in Midian. So, two princes, you see, on both sides, important people. And you can see how, well, you know, those Midianites and others, you know, how they got in, everybody involved in it from top to bottom in order to destroy the people of Israel, to bring on the wrath of God upon them. And Balaam, knew that very well. So you can see how insidious that person was, how deceitful he was, how evil he was, on one hand, and on the other hand, as a righteous man. How can that be? Well, unfortunately, that's the way human beings are. On one hand, you know, they can be, like Christ said about some people in his day, you know, on the outside, they look like white sepulchres, you know, white and nice and, you know, and pretty. But on the inside, that's a different story. And so we have to be careful of people like that. That's what God says, you know, and Jesus Christ, by their fruit you shall know them. You have to check them and prove them, see what kind of people they really are before you fall for their devices and you follow them. You know, they like to appear like people of God, servants of God, and things like that, and they deceive many. That's what Christ was saying. Many shall come in my name saying that I am the Christ. You know, they pretend to be righteous people. That's what Paul is warning us about. That certain the devil likes to appear as an angel of light, and his ministers like to appear as ministers of righteousness. And so they do a lot of right things, and they deceive people, and people follow them into all kind of mischief. That's the reason why the people of God are jointly led astray into deception, because all these people come and deceive them. And here it is, one of the princes of Israel is leading others to follow in his footsteps, couldn't care less about God, about the law, about, you know, his religion, his heritage, his future and all that. There are people like that in our midst to this very day, unfortunately. And this is what happened. And that was the end of both of them. You know, one stalk, two birds, one stone. This time it was one spear. And God said, I'm going to reward you for that with an everlasting priesthood. And verse 16, and the Eternal spoke unto Moses, saying, you see, that's not the end of the story. Now there are all, you know, there are all those Midianites and others who were guilty of partaking in this matter. And apparently the Midianites were the most guilty in this matter. And they were the ones also that were responsible for bringing Balaam to come and curse Israel. And so this is what we read here in verse 17. Harass the Midianites. In other words, go seek their hurt, not their good. Be an enemy to them. And the word in Hebrew is tzaror. Tzaror means, you know, be an enemy to them. Tzorer in Hebrew is an enemy. And so he said, be an enemy to them. Harass them, Midianites, and smite them. For they harass you. They were your enemies. By their wiles wherewith they have beguiled you in this matter of Peor. And obviously they got the idea from Balaam. He's the one that told them that. And in the matter of Cozbi, the daughter of the prince of Midian, their sister. So here they are taking upon themselves, and we somehow don't see Moab involved here. Moab was involved in bringing Balaam to curse, but apparently they were not as much as involved as the Midianites here. And they were plotting. This whole thing was a plot. Now let's get, you know, our most beautiful daughters here and entice the Israelites and entice their leaders and things like that, and they fell for it. And so that's what he's saying here. In the matter of Peor, which is the worship of idols, and in the matter of Cozbi, and this is, in other words, a part of the orgies that the pagans generally had, was the worship of idols and fornication. In other words, sex, and that always attracts men, especially who have no morals, no fear of God. That was a problem, even with the Corinthians and many other churches of the Gentiles, because they had all those temples there, the temple prostitutes. And Paul speaks about that, but the weakness that many of the Corinthians had in the church, still were going to temple prostitutes because, you know, that was their culture and background. And they are taught, well, this is one way to worship God, you see. So that's how they always regarded it. They didn't see anything wrong with that. They thought that was righteous. That's how they deceived many of the children of Israel, who themselves, you know, were already exposed to it in Egypt and other places. And so he said, you go and become an enemy to them because of these things that they have done, and because of the daughter of the prince of Midian, their sister, who was slain on the day of the plague in the midst of Peor. The whole thing was one package. And it came to pass after the plague, and we read here, we're going to chapter 26 now in verse 1. So after the plague, we read here, and the Lord spoke unto Moses and unto Eleazar the son of, that is, he's the priest now, the high priest, instead of his father, son of Aaron, the priest, saying, take the sum of all the congregation of the children of Israel from 20 years old and upward by their father's houses, all that are able to go forth to war in Israel, the adults between 20 and 50, and Moses and Eleazar, the priest, spoke with them in the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho. And that's a short time before they're about to enter into the land, and this is what they do there. And he spoke to them, saying, take the sum of the people from 20 years old and upward, as the Lord commanded Moses and the children of Israel that came forth out of the land of Egypt. And so here we have a census before they're going to go to war. Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, the sons of Reuben, Hanoch, the family of the Hanochites, of Phalu, the family of Paluites, of Hetzron, the family of the Hetzronites, of Carmi, the family of Carmites. These are the families of the Reubenites, and that were, you know, and they that were numbered of them were 43,730. Now, you compare it with the other census they had, and you can see a difference there in terms of growth. Verse 8, and the sons of Palu, Eliab, the sons of Eliab, Nimuel, and Dathan, and Abiram. So these were the children of Reuben, and you remember earlier, in the rebellion of Korah, Datan and Aviram were destroyed by God because of their wickedness. These are, it says here, these are Datan and Aviram, the elect of the congregation, you know, chief leaders, who strove against Moses and against Aaron and the company of Korah when they strove against the Lord. So it's more, it was not just Moses, but against the Lord himself. And the earth opened her mouth and swallowed them up together with Korah when the company died. What time the fire devoured 250 men. So it's just recounting what happened to these two. In other words, sort of an infamous remark here about these people. So that's their mention here, honorable mention. And they became a sign, you know, a sign to Israel. You're following their footsteps, that's where you're going to end up. Verse 11, notwithstanding, the sons of Korah died not. Why? You see, because God, that's the law of God. The sons should not be paying for the penalty of the parents. So when you read about Korah at that time, you get the impression all of them died. And it's not correct. No, it's, you know, you have to read the whole story. And here, he's adding a piece of information that was not recorded there. That he died, you know, those very close to him, those who followed him and the attitude and all that, but not necessarily his sons who did not follow his example. And so, it says, notwithstanding, the sons of Korah died not, the sons of Simeon, after their families of Nemuel, the family of the Neumite, of Jamin, the family of the Jamites, of Yachin, the family of Jachinites, of Zara, the family of the Zarahite. Now Zara was also a son of Judah. Well, this is a different Zara. And of Shaul, the family of the Shaulites. These are the families of the Simeonites, 22,200. And some among them died because of the plague here, with the fornication that they committed. And the sons of Gad, after their families, of Sephon, the family of the Sephonite, of Haggai. Haggai being, you know, one of them of the prophets later on. Haggai means my feast. Hag, the family of the Haggites, of Shuni, the family of the Shunites, of Ozni, the family of the Oznites, of the family of the Arites, of Arod, the family of the Arodites, of Areli, the family of the Arelites. These are the families of the sons of Gad, according to those that were numbered of them, 40,500. Now Gad was a big tribe, twice as big than the tribe of Simeon. And verse 18, these are the families of the sons of Gad, according to those that were numbered of them, 40,500. The sons of Judah, Aaron, Onan, of course they're all dead, and Aaron, Onan died in the land of Canaan. And the sons of Judah, after their families, were of Shelah, the family of the Shelahites, of Perez, the family of the Perezites, of Zara, the family of the Zarahites. So now he had three sons, one from the first wife, and then Perez and Zara came from Tamar, his daughter-in-law. And this basically makes the Jewish people. And the sons of Perez were of Hezron, the family of the Hezronite, excuse me, of Hamul, the family of the Hamulites. These are the families of Judah, according to those that were numbered of them, 16,500, a huge tribe, three times as big as the tribe of Simeon. And mind you, he's just mentioning only the family of Shelah and the family of Perez. No mention here of Zara. A lot of people, you know, they, when they read this one, when they read the earlier census, they wonder what happened to Zara. When they came down to Egypt, the children of Zara are not mentioned at all. You see, only of Perez. And when you study history, you find out what happened. The family of Zara, most of them did not even go down to Egypt. They didn't, were not happy. You know, there was a family dispute there. They were not happy with the fact that Perez, and mind you, Zara and Perez were twin brothers, but Zara came first, and then Perez sort of pushed through and came out first. You know, you have to read that story, the birth of these two twins. And Zara technically is the firstborn, Perez, which means burst forth, and that's the quality of many of the Jews, you know, they're just pushy. And they could be bad, could be good. Because of that, you know, they become the leaders. But, you know, when they abuse that, it's not too pleasant. And so the family of Zara, that basically took off, and historic records tell us that they went up to the Caspian Sea, they remained there in that territory, and they became later on known as the Scythian, you know, in Scythia, and Iber Siot, or Iber the Scot, the wanderer, that's what it means, Scot, wanderer. He brought them finally into Ireland, and from there into Scotland, and so the family of Zara basically ended up, even though some of them went to different places in Europe, ultimately most of them ended up in Scotland. So in Scotland you find the other line of Judah from Zara, the twin brother of Perez. And that's the reason why they have the same qualities in many ways when you compare the Scots and the Jews. And they get along you know, beautifully together. Many things in common. Anyway, that's a part of history that unless you know the whole history of the tribes of Israel, where they went, you know, this may sound to be a little bit strange. But that's reality, and a lot of Scots, at least knowledgeable ones, know that history of theirs. And for some who want to read a very fascinating history about that, read the latest book of Prince Michael of Albany. He's, in essence, a potential heir to the throne of Scotland, if England ever allows him to do it. And he wrote in his latest book, what is it called? The Forgotten Monarchy of Scotland, something like that, by Prince Michael of Albany. He wrote three books of the same title, The Forgotten Monarchy of Scotland, and he basically has this information there also. So it's not something that is strange when you think about it. You know, records of history are there, but even though there aren't many, still, it's there. God preserved it. He preserved the history of his people, and this man knows very well his ancestry and where his people came from, and where the royalty of Scotland and Ireland and England, you know, came from, all from the line of David, and also from the line of Zara, which was the brother of Perez, the father of David. Anyway, side point here, history. So these are the people of Judah, minus Zara. If you put them all together, obviously there would be many more. And to this very day, a lot of people don't realize, and especially a lot of Jews obviously don't realize, that there are actually many more than they really are. In other words, a lot of Jews are unknown Jews. Not only the Scots, but you know, there are many others, and they really number. If you take all of them together, the number is still in the many, many, many millions. Not tens of millions, but it could be at least 200 million even today. You know, which is very shocking to even for a Jew, but that's reality. One of these days we're going to find out all these things, and nobody's going to be shocked anymore. Anyway, in verse 23, and the sons of Issachar, after their families of Tola, the families of the Tolaite, of Puva, the family of the Punites, of Yeshub, the family of the Yeshuvite, you know, may sound like strange names, but these are the names of the forefathers of the Israelites. And, you know, you might say this is ancient history for American history, English history, you know, European history, that is Northwestern Europe, and so forth. These are the parents, their forefathers, and one of these days are going to meet them and talk to them, and, you know, if they know their names as they read it here, they'll be able to address them, and hopefully they would learn a little Hebrew so they can address them by their real names and not, you know, the little different names that you see here when you read it in English. And many of them, it's exactly the same in others, minor changes there. Verse 25, now these are the families of Issachar, according to those that were numbered of them, 84,000 and 300. And then we continue with verse 26. And the sons of Zvulun, after their families of Sered, the family of the Seredites, of Elon, the family of the Elonites, of Yahleel, the family of the Yahleelites, these are the families of the Zebulunites, according to those that were numbered of them, 84,500. Well, here is Zebulun, a huge tribe again, almost just as big as Judah. And verse 28, the sons of Joseph, now we are coming to Joseph, after the families, Manasseh and Ephraim, two of them, the sons of Manasseh, he begins with the firstborn of Machir, the family of the Machirites, and Machir begat Gilead, you know, the land of Gilead, east bank, where the Jordanians are today squatting, you know, in the land that is not theirs, and they don't realize one of these days it's going to be given back to the land, people of Israel as they return to their land. And the family of the Gileadites, and these are the people that is Manasseh, was on the east bank, they did not go into the land. and Reuben was also on the east bank, and also Gad, or only Manasseh, was half of Manasseh remained on one side, and the other half went to the other side of the Jordan. So they were divided here between east and west. And they were known as such, and they developed different cultures as time went by, and the people of Manasseh on the east bank developed cultural traits and things like that. They were closer, more to the French people. That is the Reubenites, the people, the ancestors of the French people. And you can see that to this very day, not only in the old countries, but even in this country, in the New Orleans area, you see there the Manassites and the people of Reuben, French. And so this is a little bit of history here. And so the sons of Manasseh of Machir, the family of the Machirites, and Machir begat Gilead, and Gilead the family of the Gileadites. These are the sons of Gilead, of Jezer, the family of the Jezerites, of Helek, the family of the Helekites, of Asriel, and the family of the Asrielites, and of Shechem, the family of the Shechemites. And Shechem, remember, that's a city that was destroyed by the children of Levi, the children of Jacob, that is, Levi and Simeon. And so apparently they took that name and adopted it and used it as a name also. Shechem basically means shoulder, that's all it means. Verse 32. And of Shemidah, the family of the Shemidahites, and of Hefer, the family of the Heferites. Of course, if you know Hebrew, you know what those names mean. They, you know, it takes a little bit more meaning there. And then also at the same time, you have to realize that genealogy was extremely important for Israel, because that's how they knew what, where they came from, who are there, you see, what land to be given. And when you understand that, you realize how important it is. So as they went into even captivity, they retained their ancestry, and they retained, you know, the history of their, where they came from, and their families, not only in terms of the tribe, but also the particular family, you know, the clans. That's why when you come to Scotland and Ireland, things like that, you see a lot of this practice of keeping a name of your clan. And they've been all over Europe also for a long time before they become nations, and then you lose the concept. But among themselves, to this very day, you see the clans still sticking together, and they become very clannish. You see, they stick only together with themselves, and that's only where they preserve their identity, you see, within the tribe. And so this kind of information, you know, when you read it and it's all there and you pass it on from generation to generation, it becomes a trait of the of that particular family to maintain that identity, not only in terms of the nation or the people of the tribe, but even in terms of the family that later on became known as a clan. And you go to Ireland and Scotland, you hear a lot of that, but, you know, the different names of the clans, and people know where they came from, what clan they came from. Of course, today now they have totally different names, but these are the very descendants of this very people that we are reading about here. And some of them still know it. Most of them have lost this information, but some still preserve it, and it is there to this very day for those who like to dig into it. And here we read again about some of the children of Manasseh. And Slophad, the son of Hefer, had no sons. That's a famous story about the daughters of Slophad. He had daughters. And the names of the daughters of Tzophad were Machlai, Noah, and Hoglai, and Milcah, and Tirzah. These are the families of Manasseh. Now, these are mentioned here later on when they came to Moses and asked him for a piece of land, since, you know, they had no sons in their family. The father didn't have sons, so they said, well, why should we be without a land just because, you know, our father had no sons? So Moses didn't know what to do about it, brought it to God, and God took care of that. And then later on, that story reappeared again when the people of Israel from this very family wanted to know from Joshua what happens if, you know, these daughters who are going to receive a piece of land, if they marry somebody from another tribe, they're going to lose a part of their own tribe. And so Joshua took care of that too. That is, God told him what to do. They should marry only within their own family, not even tribe, but within their own family, so it stays together. So, you know, it shows you how important was genealogy for sake of keeping the land and the people together. And they kept, you know, this kind of traits and cultural identity and clannish identity for a long, long time because of that. And so Well, when you see it from that point of view, then begin to realize why God recorded all these things. It is important to Him that people remain within their own family, not only within their own tribe, but within their own family, and intermarry that way. Obviously, not too close.
Verse 30. Well, I think we'll stop at this point. This is again Mordecai Joseph, greetings to all of God's people. Until next time.